Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Castaway by Joanna Campbell Slan. Narrated by M. Eldridge. Chapter 1. Hanging the closed sign in the front door of the treasure chest this morning struck me as incredibly sad. Underneath, I added, "Will reopen later today." My printing isn't as neat as Sky Blue's, but the message was clear. This wasn't a forever closing. Not by a long shot. Still, the signage caused a lump in my throat. I've never closed the store on a typical business day before, especially on a crucial sales day like Valentine's Day. I shook my head, trying to banish my negative thoughts. "Not today," I told myself. "Don't go there." Despite the warmth of the sun shining through the big display windows, a cold draft gave me goosebumps. "Just another Valentine's Day in paradise," I said to the sales floor. No one heard me but the refurbished furniture, the handmade decor items, and the charming soft goods. To chase away the chill, I rubbed the skin on my upper arms and walked briskly until I stood in front of our big display of Highwaymen paintings. The Highwaymen are a group of 26 African-American painters, 25 men and one woman. They are largely self-taught. Initially, their work was undervalued. The painters had sold pieces by the side of the highway, Federal Highway, right out of the trunks of their cars. Back then, soldiers were taking advantage of the GI Bill to build new homes. Original oil paintings by the Highwaymen were perfect for decorating the walls of their houses. People snapped up pictures while the paint was still wet, sometimes paying as little as $25. Today, Highwaymen paintings sell for thousands, even hundreds of thousands of dollars. My store, the Treasure Chest, boasts one of the largest collections of Highwaymen paintings in the world. 13 were hanging in front of me, and nearly 100 were in a vault I'd had built along the opposite wall of my store. The Highwaymen painters capture an authentic Florida that most people have never seen. Every paint stroke conveys their deep love for a vanishing landscape. They have painted the slow-moving St. Lucie River, the gray man's beard moss hanging from trees, the snowy egrets stalking small fish in shallow water, and the gently arching palm trees. To look at a Highwayman painting is to immerse yourself in the glories of nature. If you love Florida, this work will speak to you in a way that fills your heart with joy. Underneath the Highwaymen paintings on display was a slender white desk and a matching chair. This work area struck me quiet without MJ Austin. She's a full-time employee and a dear friend, the caretaker of our collection. Yesterday, she worked all day on changing out the artwork on display. She has an intensely personal connection with the Highwaymen and their art. "MJ will be back before you know it," I told the paintings on the wall. My father always laughed at how I talked to inanimate objects, but really, it's not much different from talking to yourself, is it? "Honest. Until then, Sky and I will take good care of you." Of course, the landscapes didn't talk back. They looked as forlorn as I felt. If MJ were here, she would point out the color palettes, the subject matter, the brush strokes, and give me a short tutorial on what made the work of each Highwayman unique. She never missed an opportunity to teach me more about their art. But MJ wasn't here. I hurried into the back room. To the right, my office sat empty and ready for me to tackle a mountain of paperwork. In front of me was a bank of kitchen cabinets, a sink, and a refrigerator. To the left was a door, and then the small corner where Honora McAfee, our resident miniaturist, had cobbled together a work area. This, too, was empty. Without the lively personalities who helped me run the store, The treasure chest was as flat as a glass of champagne without its bubbles. The most pitiful sight of all was the round table and empty chairs where my employees and I usually gather to take our breaks. Today, the spot seemed lifeless and empty. Another reminder of the seriousness of the day. On a shelf in one of the uppermost cabinets, I found a votive candle. Using a match, I lit it. After setting it in the sink, I bowed my head. Please, God, look after MJ. Help her surgeon take good care of her. Help all of us to comfort her and give her strength for what lies ahead. Bless her and bless us, and hold all of us in the palm of your hand. Amen. A light touch on my arm startled me. Sky bowed her head and took her spot next to me. Her hand sought mine, and when our fingers connected, her grip was strong and sure. We stood there in silence for what seemed like a long time, but probably wasn't. A rapping on the back door jerked us to our senses. Honora McAfee stood on the stoop with her daughter Evelyn right behind her. The four of us climbed into my black Camry. What an odd picture we must have made. I had on jeans and an aqua V-neck tee. Sky wore a gray and moss-green gauzy skirt and an open weave sweater. Honora was prim in a lavender and white striped seersucker shirtwaist dress, and Evelyn wore tailored gray pants and a matching sleeveless blouse in a gray and pink ombre shading. I was surprised that Evelyn had joined us. She has Asperger's syndrome, and any change of schedule is difficult for her. This morning represented a challenge for all of us. Usually, the store opens at 9, but today we'd gathered at 8 to make the trip to the hospital together. Usually, we're happy to see each other. Today, we were all on edge. Evelyn reminded me of the speed limit twice, before I pulled into an empty parking space at Martin Memorial Hospital. When we hopped out, Evelyn stood at the back bumper and pointed. Your car is crooked. There should be a foot of space on each side, but there are only 10 inches on this one and 14 on the other. Evelyn, remember what we talked about at home? Today is a day to be kind, her mother said. Good luck with that, I muttered under my breath. Sky giggled. Here, I tossed my car keys to Evelyn. You straighten out my car and meet us inside. That made her happy. The rest of us walked through the hospital entrance. Ahead was a raised platform with signage that declared welcome. Yet the woman at the desk looked anything but. The white-haired volunteer in a pink smock paid no attention to us. Instead, she arranged items we couldn't see. The movement of her arms as they stacked and straightened invisible objects was the only clue that she was alive. Ma'am? Sky's polite request for attention was met with a stern look through a pair of trifocals. We're here to see a friend, MJ Austin. Mary Jane's her given name.
Pre-op, get your visitor badges first. Over there.
A withered hand directed us to another desk as Evelyn rejoined us. Blessedly, the volunteer in charge of badges moved briskly, and soon we each had a photo ID clipped to our clothes. After I grabbed a map of the facility, we were on our way, heading for a bank of elevators. The stink of freshly popped popcorn, disinfectant, and rubbing alcohol brought a tsunami of memories. Sky noticed. She always does. She slipped her arm through mine. Remember, for everyone who works here, this is business as usual. Just another day. For us, this is a big deal. We need to take comfort from the fact they're used to this. They're prepared for anything that can happen. This is their area of specialty. Little by little, my muscles unclenched. Being uptight wouldn't help MJ. To the contrary, she might pick up on my nerves, and that would make her qualms worse.
My job was to support her, not to freak her out. Deep breaths. Sky modeled her directions with a long, slow inhale. I mimicked her. Peacefulness filled me, although I knew the relief would only be temporary. The pre-op lounge for family and friends was well-appointed and comfortable. A beige leather sofa was bookended by two matching armchairs. Beige and blue-green pillows decorated the seats. Evelyn immediately sat down in the exact middle of the couch. The map explained what amenities were available and where they were located. The charge nurse hurried over, and we introduced ourselves. I had hoped we could speak to MJ before she went in for surgery, but the nurse explained that Pete Slatkin was with her, and he'd be joining us momentarily. Tall, thin, and balding, Pete's expression was grave, and his eyes were moist.
They rolled her in about 5 minutes ago. Took her early. She's in good hands. The anesthesiologist and I have known each other for years. He told me that her surgeon is top-notch. I've heard the same from everyone.
How is MJ? I asked.
Terrified. Not so much of the surgery. You know how MJ feels about her breasts.
Pete ran a hand over his chin as he took one of the wing-back chairs on either side of the sofa.
You would think that a woman so beautiful would realize there's more to love about her than a set of...
He shook his head. He didn't need to finish. We all have our weaknesses, our blind spots, especially when it comes to seeing ourselves, Honora said. She sat down in a wing-back chair that matched the one where Pete was seated. Yes, we all have our blind spots, but for most women, their breasts are emblematic of their femininity. MJ had confided in me that she was not only worried about their removal, she also worried about how she'd look, period. She fretted that her clothes wouldn't fit right until she had reconstruction surgery. I doubt that I own a single blouse or dress that isn't low-cut. Now what? Do I buy scarves and try to disguise the fact I've had a mastectomy? Sky and I took the two chairs opposite of Honora and Pete. A part of me thought, what's a new wardrobe compared to your health? Another part of me understood entirely. MJ loved looking good. She really did. As her employer, I appreciated her pleasant appearance, too. As another woman, I realized why this was a traumatic experience. On some level, she was focusing on her clothes because that was easier than facing her deepest fears.
Oh, Pete, I'm sorry we weren't here in time to tell MJ. To wish her...
I stopped. What exactly would we have told her? That she was going to live happily ever after? That might have been a lie. Okay is a relative term. What's okay for you might not be good enough for me. Not at all.
No problem,
Pete sighed.
You didn't know they'd take her in early. MJ realizes that you care about her. Everything considered, she was pretty calm. Especially after Father Francisco came by and blessed her. You know him, don't you?
Yes, I had him bless the shop.
You did?
Pete looked amazed. Remember when we took care of that cockatoo? Before we found it a good home? Poppy went ballistic. I guess my late grandmother drummed it into Poppy's head how terrible it was to have a bird in the house. Poppy kept badgering me about the bad luck. Finally, I got tired of hearing him rattle on and on about the potential disaster. And I phoned the church. They sent Father Fantastic.
Father Fantastic?
Pete blinked repeatedly. His red-rimmed eyes suggested he hadn't gotten much sleep.
That's rich.
Sky giggled about Father Fantastic.
That's the nickname the woman who runs the church office gave Father Francisco. She told Kara, and I quote, "He's handsome, debonair, well-educated, and in line to work at the Vatican. That makes him fantastic in my book. My female customers at the deli used to complain that it was a total waste of gorgeous manhood to have him pledge to celibacy. Why, Kara, you're blushing.
Uh-huh. This conversation made me uncomfortable. I grew up in the Roman Catholic Church. Reliably, the priests of my childhood were older than mud and creaky as rusted door hinges. Given that history, I'd been shocked when Father Fantastic walked into the store. He was in his late 30s and as handsome as a young Cary Grant. His black cassock gave him a dramatic flair that set off his chiseled good looks. His deep, melodic voice added to his charm.
Father Fantastic, huh? Interesting. I can see how he could charm the socks off some of his parishioners. As for MJ, you'd never guess that a blessing by a priest would matter so much to her, would you? She grew up Seventh-day Adventist, converted to Catholicism when she married her fifth husband, and then fell away from the church after their divorce. They say there are no atheists in foxholes, so it makes sense that she'd embrace her faith now. Of course, I have to take a little credit. MJ's been coming to church regularly with my mother and me.
When did she start that? I asked.
Shortly after she was diagnosed, Pete said.
Honora nodded sagely. I've known MJ for years and years. That woman took to Catholicism like the proverbial duck to water. As they say in poker, she went all in. Even so, she still has a hard time with celebrations. That's when her Seventh-day Adventist upbringing comes to the forefront. Otherwise, it's been a perfect match. She's told me she loves everything about the Catholic Church. She still believes marriage is holy, even if she can't take communion.
She might be able to take communion again. We're working on that.
Pete sounded matter-of-fact. Really? I raised an eyebrow.
Father Francisco says he can expedite the process that grants her an annulment of her previous marriage. You see, she was only married in the church once after she converted. Considering all the donations I've made, he should be able to push the paperwork through.
I thought annulments weren't expensive. I remember my mother saying as much.
The price varies,
Pete frowned.
Some go more smoothly than others. MJ is hoping to get this taken care of. I would like to get it done too, for personal reasons.
Good, I said. At heart, MJ's a romantic. The church has a lot for her to love. History, pageantry, drama, beauty. Solace and faith, Honora added. Pete, I imagine you've been up since dawn, Sky said.
Why don't you close your eyes and try to get a little rest? MJ will need you when she wakes up.
I couldn't sleep. Not last night. Certainly not now.
With a weary hand, he scrubbed at his face.
But I could use a cup of coffee.
Sky bounced to her feet.
I'll go down to the cafeteria and bring back a cup for you. Their coffee has to be better than the vending machine swill. Who else wants one? Kara, will you come with me? I'll need help carrying everything without spilling.
The cafeteria wasn't far away. Sky's memory as a waitress was spectacular. And of course, she remembered all the subtleties of everyone's requests. Soon, we were back in the surgery lounge with drinks for all. The hot beverages had a calming effect. Maybe we needed a distraction. Despite the disruption to her schedule, Evelyn seemed to have found her equilibrium. She worked steadily on a piece that required hand-stitching, closing up the adorable tortilla warming bags she was making for my store. Realizing that I could do with a bit of stress release, too, I pulled a book of Sudoku puzzles from my purse. Sky and Honora had both brought projects. Honora was working on a dollhouse-sized needle punch rug, while Sky was weaving a bracelet. Pete read a book on his iPhone. Thus settled in, and with our coffees and teas to sip, we took comfort in each other's company.
The minutes trudged along, marching slowly toward our futures. I did my best to concentrate on my puzzles, although I was only partially successful. I could tell by my poor results that I wasn't at my best. Thank goodness I'd brought along a pencil with a fresh eraser. I kept writing numbers and rubbing them away, hoping to occupy my mind. When Pete interrupted the silence with a question for me, I was relieved. He pitched his voice low, just above a whisper.
Kara, the painting will be secure, won't it?
Gently, he adjusted the collar of his shirt to give his huge Adam's apple more room.
MJ worried about the painting all night. Not that she doesn't trust you, after what happened before.
She gets nervous. I'm not surprised. Essie Feldman, the founding owner of the treasure chest, had collected highwaymen paintings for decades, up until the time a stroke put her in the hospital. At first, it was touch and go as to whether Essie would make it or not. When it was clear she would survive, the doctors cautioned her that her recovery was going to be slow. Months of rehab would be necessary to get her back on her feet. Given that the treasure chest would be short-staffed, and since the summer months are slow anyway, Essie decided to close her store temporarily. Locking the doors would allow her to remodel the second floor, turning it from one large apartment into twin apartments so that Essie's rental income would double. MJ was Essie's right hand and helper. The store's hiatus gave MJ a chance to fly to Michigan to see her own ailing mother. While MJ was gone, the paintings disappeared. They went missing for years. Stewart is a small town. Not surprisingly, the local gossips blamed MJ. Sadly, she blamed herself. Although she'd flown to Michigan with Essie's blessing, MJ felt guilty. Essie's business never recovered from the loss of her paintings, and Essie never fully recovered from her stroke. Shortly after the paintings went missing, Essie died. Growing up, I'd spent my summers here in Stewart. My parents always rented Essie's large apartment above the store. When I discovered that the treasure chest was defunct, I bought the abandoned building and reopened my version of the store. Not long after, we recovered Essie's vast collection of highwaymen paintings. Only then did the dark cloud of suspicion that had dogged MJ begin to fade away. Needless to say, MJ is now overly protective of the artwork. Pete gave me a weak smile.
Don't get me wrong. MJ is delighted that one of Essie's paintings will be auctioned off for a good cause. The Valentine's Day Gala is a great opportunity to promote the collection and your store. But she's torn. She sees all the paintings as her personal responsibility. It worries her because she won't be at the gala to make sure the artwork is safe. It isn't that she doesn't trust you, Kara. She does. She's just a worrywart when it comes to Essie's art collection. Irving's art collection.
Irving Feldman is Essie's son. After Essie died, he inherited all her worldly goods, including his mother's missing collection. Back then, Irving was struggling financially. His wife had been recently diagnosed with MS. He couldn't run his mother's store by himself. He didn't realize what an asset MJ was. Worst of all, Irving didn't know enough about business to understand how to make the treasure chest profitable again. Eventually, he closed the store and put the building up for sale. That's when I stepped in. I know MJ worries. I promised her I would review the event's security when I got to the hotel ballroom, and I will. Not that I'm an expert or anything on hotel security, but I'll take photos of the setup and send them to MJ. Our highwayman painting will be a wonderful addition to the auction. There are so many wealthy people in this area. They're all eager to help with a good cause.
I'm sure the painting will be fine.
You've seen the other auction items?
Pete raised one curious eyebrow. Not yet, but MJ helped the organizer, Quinn Faraday, identify and value most of them. The list looks fabulous on paper.
What's the schedule for this evening?
Load-in for smaller items starts at 11. Large items will be added between 2 and 3. The event will open at 6 for the special preview.
That doesn't give people much time, does it? Sounds to me like everyone will have to hustle.
Yes, the timing is tight, but that isn't unusual for an event like this. When my family owned our restaurant, we catered more of these than I care to remember. There was always a mad dash to the finish line. In fact, it'll seem odd to be on this side of the operation, instead of being responsible for the room setup and food.
Sounds like this will be a breeze for you. You'll dress up, you'll go, you'll act charming. People will fall in love with the painting and come check out the store.
He rubbed his chin. That's the plan.
Maybe that's why MJ was keen to have her operation now instead of waiting until after the gala. She knew I'd be miserable at a fancy society event. I'd much rather be staring at the backside of a horse than mingling with a lot of horses' rear ends.
Pete's a veterinarian. Attending swanky events isn't part of his job description. I laughed at his prediction that he'd be miserable, even though both of us knew that if MJ had asked him to attend the gala, he would have been happy to accompany her. Going to the gala might not sound like a hardship for me, but it isn't high on my wish list either. I'd be thrilled if MJ were going instead. She can answer specific questions about the painting and the artists, and I can't. I'll probably spend my whole evening saying, "I don't know, but I'll ask MJ." I wish she'd waited to have her surgery.
I know. I tried to talk MJ into waiting, but she wouldn't listen. Now that she knows the cancer is there, she wants it gone. She thinks of the disease as an invasion that has to be stopped. That's technically true, and I admire her fighting spirit. But a few days wouldn't have made a difference. We could have attended the gala, enjoyed a nice Valentine's Day, had a couple of glasses of champagne by candlelight, and then...
He smiled wistfully.
I had planned to ask her to marry me on Valentine's Day. I can still do that, but I'd hoped for a more romantic setting than this.
We sat in an alcove off of an antiseptic corridor. From our seats, we had a panoramic view of orderlies pushing metal carts and medical personnel hurrying around in their scrubs. The only welcoming distractions were a pile of dodgy magazines on the scratched coffee table, a faded abstract print on the walls, and two plastic ficus trees in tatty baskets. As hospitals went, this place was nice enough, but for a marriage proposal, it was the pits.
I hope MJ says yes. I've been asking her for years, but I don't think she took me seriously. I worship the ground she walks on, and she knows it.
I was surprised to hear that MJ had turned down his previous proposals. She would be a lucky woman to marry you, Pete. I meant every word of it. I'd never met a kinder man than Pete Slatkin.
No matter how the surgery turns out, I'll never quit loving her, even if she sends me packing.
In the weeks leading up to MJ's surgery, she had rebuffed all our attempts to baby her. We wanted her to be well-rested for her operation, but she wouldn't cut back on her hours. She refused to let me fatten her up with homemade pasta and pastries. She wouldn't let Sky come to her house and make her environment more comfy for her post-op recovery. Her stubborn refusal of assistance irked us all. Finally, Evelyn said,
I would want to be left alone. Maybe MJ does, too.
Evelyn was right.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?